First of all, I want to thank Ursula for inviting me here, because earlier this afternoon somebody said one learns most by teaching, and this has been my experience for the past 16 years, that I have learned because I was forced to. And here I was forced to study Eckhart. Although I've admired him for many years, I never studied him. So when she invited me to give a talk, well, naturally, I had to sit down and actually do it. And I found it most fascinating. Fascinating from my personal standpoint, which I'll elaborate on because it has a bearing on what I'm saying. The fascination was the fact that what he's saying and what the Buddha is saying is identical. It's just the terminology, which is totally different. And that fascination to me is so great that I thought, well, this is something one really needs to share. And the way I have already been sharing it a little is because I have a center in Germany where I stay 6 to 7 months in a year, and I have open house every Wednesday evening, where the people of the area are invited to come and learn meditation and meditate with us. And I give a little talk before, and I've been mentioning Meister Eckhart and his analogy with the Buddhist teaching, and they've been delighted because every single one of them is Catholic. We are in a Catholic area. It's a Catholic area of Germany which is adjacent to Austria and adjacent to Switzerland. So I don't think there's anybody living there except us who isn't Catholic. We are very well accepted. The whole area is very interested in us. We've had the Katholische Landjugend, the youth group, Catholic youth group visiting us. The Pfadfinder, what is Pfadfinder in English? Scouts. Scouts have come to visit us. We've had the religion teacher of the next village come to learn meditation. And so we have a real ecumenical situation there. And Meister Eckhart has contributed greatly to this. So I'm extremely grateful for having been invited to do this, because otherwise I don't think I would ever have really gone into it. The other thing which I'd like to mention also, I have already mentioned it once, but I will again. I'm not a scholar, so I have to ask for your indulgence. I'm strictly relying on Maurice Walsh's translation. I didn't agree with his English from German, I still took it because I presume him to know more about it than I do. So and my gratitude to the scholars is great, even in Buddhism. I wouldn't be able to read a thing if the scholars hadn't translated it from Pali into English and also partially into German. We still don't have all of it in German. We have all of it in English. The Pali Text Society has existed in England for over 100 years, and the first translations were made by a couple who were devoted Catholics, and of course they made quite a few mistakes in the translation, but our gratitude is great to them, because otherwise we would all have to learn Pali perfectly in order to say anything about the Buddha. This way we can just read it in our own language and go ahead with it. So this, I think, is also this fruitful cross-fertilization that we have with each other. And the Buddha taught pariyatti patipatti, which means study and practice. He did not teach just one or the other. He said both for each person. So I feel that if we want to practice in this way, we really all need to have some practice and all need to have some study. So I don't think that we have a diversity of interest. I think we have a conjunction of interest where we help each other with whatever we know a little better. And so I feel that this is an important aspect of the whole teaching. What I have done is something I never do. I brought these papers along. But in this case, it's absolutely essential. I have to use paper. Namely, I have picked out a few of Meister Eckhart's sermons and have found, after about 2 months of searching and reading and trying to understand it better, the equivalent in the Buddha's teachings. And I have also xeroxed the Buddhist discourses and pasted them on next to the sermons so that they are next to each other. And the explanation of it I will give you, but the terminology is so different that at first thought one thinks that they're talking about different things. With that in mind, I'd like to mention one other thing. Several people have asked me, why are you interested in Meister Eckhart? I mean, aren't you sufficiently occupied with the Buddha? Well, quite so. But when I became a Buddhist nun, somebody handed me, and I can't remember who, The Interior Castle by Teresa d'Avila. And since I had nothing else to read and nothing else to do at that time, I thought, well, I must have a look at that. And I read it, and I was fascinated, because what I found was that she's explaining in her seven chambers of the mansion our eight steps of meditation. And what I did was I made a little dictionary using her terminology and putting ours next to it. And then after a while, I got all the books that exist by Teresa d'Avila and studied them to quite an extent. So then going from her to Meister Eckhart wasn't a very long step. It's the same tradition. It's a Christian mystical tradition. The other thing which fascinated me, which is only a side view, but I think maybe the personal aspect's not uninteresting, Teresa d'Avila was Jewish. So am I. And I thought, well, I can really relate to what this woman is saying. And one of the things which I really loved and which is something that really got me very much in tune with that kind of thought was one time she said, I don't need another holy nun. I need another one that cleans the toilets. And this is exactly the way I feel about it. But now back to my stakeout. The first sermon which I picked out is Sermon 85 out of Maurice Walsh's translation. And I'm only going to read out those little passages which I find are pertinent. What I have tried to do is find the methodology. The Buddha has an extremely detailed and exact method of how to go from here to there. Namely, from our ordinary aspect of duality thinking, of the daily aspect of you and me, them and us, tomorrow and yesterday, good and bad, wanting and disliking, to get from that to the unity and unifying aspect of a mind which relates to universality. Now, he has a method, and we use this method. Obviously, the method includes meditation. I tried to find it in Meister Eckhart, and I think I did. But, as was said earlier, Meister Eckhart always said, this is an experiment. Well, this is exactly what this is. This is an experiment. I've never done this before, and I ask your indulgence. Meister Eckhart says, the best comparison to be found is that of body and soul. These are so closely knit that the body can do nothing without the soul, or the soul without the body. The only reason I'm picking this out is to show you that he also said mind instead of soul, because in Buddhism we use mind. He says, this true possession of God depends on the mind, an inner mental turning and striving towards God, but not in a continuous and equal thinking of him. Now, that's out of the talks of instruction. It's the only place where I could find mind, but I haven't really read every little word that I could find. So we are using mind, and we're using mind and body. And in this paragraph here, where he says soul and body, I am, instead of soul, substituting mind, because that's what we use in the Buddhist terminology. So here where he says that they're so closely knit that the body can do nothing without the mind or the mind without the body, in the Buddhist teaching, the path, the four foundations of mindfulness, is a path that goes in one way only, to the purification of beings, to the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, to the disappearance of pain and grief, to the attainment of the true way, to the realization of Nibbana. Now that is only a beginning to say what this is happening here. We have four foundations of mindfulness in the Buddhist teaching, and they are our training. And the four foundations of mindfulness concern body and mind. And so as he says, body and mind are so closely together, we shall have a look and see what else he says. Now he says, the three things, this is my stair cut, three things prevent the soul from uniting with God. The first is that she's too scattered. So the Buddha says, here a bhikkhu is a monk, abides contemplating a body as a body, fully aware and mindful. Now that means doing nothing else except what the body's actions are. So the mind no longer is scattered. That she is not unitary. Being scattered. So when the soul is inclined towards creatures, she is not unitary. This is Eckhart. I think you'll probably know which one's Eckhart, which one's a Buddha, won't you? They do talk differently. So when the soul is inclined towards creatures, she is not unitary. And the Buddha said, being fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. We put away that for the world that we want and what we don't want. So we cannot be inclined towards creatures. Now mindfulness is ekayana, the one way. It's the heart of Buddhist meditation. It's the very first training that anybody who has anything to do with Buddhism ever gets. And it will not be long enough time here to explain it all, but I want to show you that although we can't find a step-by-step description in my Meistercard, he's still talking about exactly the same thing. So all we have to do is borrow the methodology of the Buddha, and you can actually do my Meistercard, which is maybe a funny way of saying it. Now, the second is when she is involved with temporal things. So that's when the soul cannot understand or cannot come to God. She's involved with temporal things. So again, she has this covetousness and grief for the world, and she's interested in worldly things. The third is when she is turned towards the body. Now here the Buddha says, for then she cannot unite with God. He says, quite secluded from sensual desires, secluded from unprofitable dhammas, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana. In order to explain to you what these things are, the Buddhist meditation methods would take quite a long time. And I don't think you'll have enough time to hear all that. But the word jhana means meditative absorption. And the very first step is this one that is mentioned here. We are secluded from sensual desires. In other words, we are secluded from temporal things. We are not turned towards the body. The sensual desires arise because we are not comfortable, we are hungry, we are thirsty, we are bored, we want to have some entertainment, we want to have something. So when we are secluded from that, we are able to enter into first jhana. First jhana is when we can give up the meditation subject and enter into a state of being which has rapture and bliss in it. It certainly is not the goal of the meditation, but it is, in Teresa d'Avila's words, the very first step into that mansion with, in her words, seven in our words, eight chambers. We enter into the entrance hall. And those are the jhanas and meditative absorptions. And as Meister Eckhart is talking about the soul being too scattered, she's inclined towards creatures, she is turned towards a body, then she cannot unite with God. So we need to have the mindfulness as our training. And as a training in meditation, we use mindfulness on the breath. This is a traditional method. There are 40 different methods to be used. The breath is the most traditional. And the breath, as we watch the breath, we also have that understanding that mind and body are totally connected. Breath is body, mind is watching. The breath cannot possibly be watching and the mind be breathing. The two are, however, completely connected with each other, and that is mindfulness in the first instance of the body, which brings through concentration us into the jhanas. I wonder if this is totally clear, is it? Okay, all right. Next one. Now, there are three things that favor the union of God with the soul, is my statement. The first is that the soul should be simple and undivided. So again, we have simple and undivided mindfulness. Aware and mindful, the simplicity of the mind, which is not concerned with future or past. The simplicity of a mind which is straightforward and doesn't have any past or future in it, which does not have any judgment in it, which doesn't have anything in it except the meditation subject. That means that the mind is simple and undivided. It doesn't have two things. It has one. We call that one-pointedness, which is one of the factors of the meditative absorption. For if she is to be united with God, she must be simple, as God is simple. Then secondly, she should dwell above herself and above all transient things, and adhere to God. If she is to dwell above herself, we have a discourse by the Buddha where he says, at a time when the disciple thinks of the Dhamma, the teaching, his mind has no craving, hate, or delusion. His mind having the right direction, he thinks of the teaching with joy, and the mind full of joy becomes unified. So, it has to think of something which is not transient, which is not temporal, which is not worldly. The mind which thinks of that which is above the world will be a mind that becomes unified. A unified mind is the greatest jewel we can have. There's nothing which has any comparison to that. Meister Eckhart speaks of the Funkelein, the spark in the mind. We call that the seed of enlightenment. Having a mind that contains that means we have a jewel. Now, we mustn't allow this jewel to either be scratched or have any dirt poured over it. We must have it simple, undivided, and above the transient things. Now, that is what is in the training for mindfulness, which has four parts, and I will just tell you the four parts of mindfulness so that you just get an idea of what it is. The first is the body. Watching the breath in the meditation is watching part of body. Second one is feeling. Third one is direction of mind. And fourth one is content of mind. These are the four foundations of mindfulness, the four satipatthanas, which is the most important beginning instruction of the Buddha. And it has complete analogy here in Meister Eckhart's explanation, because he talks about soul, and as I said, he says soul and mind can be interchanged here, that it has to be unified. And mindfulness means that it becomes one-pointed. It is only concerned with one thing. Now, in meditation, that's obvious. It has to be. But in daily life, that instruction goes on. In daily life, we watch, first of all, body, how it moves, what it does. Is it completely on its own, or is it in partnership with the mind? Is it doing what the mind says it tells it to do? Second thing that we know is our feelings. And because we know them and become objective observers, we do not have to react to them. The moment we have done that, we have changed our life. This is something that people learn in therapy. All we need is mindfulness. If we watch our emotions, watch our feelings, and watch them as an objective observer, there's no need to react. And the same applies then to mind, which has wholesome and unwholesome content. And as we learn to watch, we also learn to change. So this is part of, very brief part of mindfulness. This is the very first, and this is a very brief, and I think it's not a complete sermon. I only picked it out because in it I could find the parts that relate to the mindfulness teaching of the Buddha. The second one, which I picked out, is Sermon 86, and it talks about insight in our language. To the soul, Meister Eckhart, that seeks God, all creatures must be a pain. It was a pain for her to see the angels, the soul. He calls the soul she because in German it's, Mois Walsh calls it she because in German she's she. So it's painful. The soul that sees God, all creatures must be a pain. It was a pain for her to see the angels. The Buddha's enlightenment speech, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the very first discourse he ever gave after the enlightenment, talks about the Four Noble Truths, including the Noble Eightfold Path. And the first two Noble Truths are that everything that exists is dukkha. Dukkha means all that is unsatisfactory. It's a word which we cannot translate completely, because it has all the connotations of pain, grief, and lamentation, unsatisfactoriness, unfulfilled, the transience of all, the impermanence of all that exists. So it's painful. That's the first noble truth. And this is what Meister Eckhart says. To the soul that sees God, all creatures must be a pain. Which means, in our language, if we're seeking Nibbana, we cannot do it until we have seen that the world is dukkha. It's our first step. We see the world is dukkha, and then we can go on the path towards that which takes us out of that. And then he has, for the soul to find God, she needs six things. This is very interesting because we have a corresponding discourse by the Buddha where he talks about six things. And the Buddha's discourses are very organized. He's got very organized, four of this, six of that, eight of this, and so on. And Meister Eckhart does the same thing, with the only difference that because we've had a continuation of the teaching on how to do it, that we don't just have to rely on the written word, because if we relied on only the Buddha's words as we have them, we wouldn't know what to do either. But we've had the continuation of the teaching which tells us exactly what to do. And because Meister Eckhart, this is my personal opinion, of course, because Meister Eckhart was stopped from continuing and his disciples were not recognized, that's why we lost the understanding on how to do what he says. Now, he's got six things. First, What was sweet to her, the soul, before must become bitter to her. That's our first step. The first step on knowledge and vision of the way. Unfortunately, it would go too far to explain it all in detail, but it concerns a discourse of the Buddha, which is called the Ratha Vinita Sutta. The Ratha Vinita Sutta, sutta means discourse, and Ratha Vinita means that it is the six coaches. It's a discourse about six coaches, or seven coaches actually, but six which take us to the seventh. And one of the steps on that, the sixth step, is called knowledge and vision of the way. And in that knowledge and vision of the way, we have six separate understandings, how we get from where we are at now to where we want to go. Now, obviously, in the Buddha's language, it's called Nibbana. In Meister Eckhart's language, it's called Godhead. It's not even called God, it's called Godhead. But let's go along with God for the time being. So first, what was sweet to her before must become bitter to her. This step in our language is, all formations are fearful. Mind and body are all formations because they are constantly breaking up. They never remain the same. Now, we know very well that our scientists have already decades ago told us that there isn't a single solid building block in the whole of the universe. Everything are energy particles coming together and falling apart. Very well. The Buddha said exactly the same thing 2,500 years ago, but he included himself. That's the only difference. We are not a solid building block. We are energy particles coming together and falling apart. And through the meditative process, it becomes a personal experience. And at that moment, it becomes something which is not desirable. And only then do we get on the way, on our path, on the spiritual path, to leave this transient temporal mode behind and become that which we really are, namely that which is all-pervading, which in Hindu terminology is tatvamasi, I am that. But it's not the I which is the me. But it is that which has been seen to be beyond that. Now, Meister Eckhart speaks, in my understanding, from the standpoint of an enlightened one. And because he does, he's so extremely difficult to understand. It's all paradox, which I've mentioned once before. We have relative and absolute reality. On the standpoint of relative reality, there are 35 people here. Each one's different. Each one's got a different name. Each one looks different. Each one has different ideas, hopes, wishes, and memories. That's a relative reality. In absolute reality, there's nobody here. Nobody at all. Just minds and bodies sitting there, which are all breaking up constantly and coming back together. Constantly. It's a constant movement. Now that can be experientially known and must have been known to Meister Eckhart. Otherwise he wouldn't have said so. This is not an intellectual statement. None of these are. These are all statements of experience which are totally in tune with exactly what we experience in meditation. Now that becomes, at that point, it's fearful. It's a fearful thing because it's all falling apart. So then, the second step. Secondly, the soul becomes too cramped for herself so that she cannot remain within herself. So in our language, the second step is all is misery. There's no inner meaning. She cannot remain with herself. There's no inner meaning to herself. We have nothing of this, but what we thought ourselves to be remains the same. We cannot no longer wish for ourselves anything because we can see that this is all falling apart. If you give it a moment's thought, can you remember what you thought a moment ago? Nobody can. All our thoughts constantly disappear. What about the breath you had a moment ago? It's gone, isn't it? It's a new one already. What about the feeling you had a moment ago, if you were aware of it? It's all gone. Constantly falling apart, the whole thing. But this has to be experiential. And that's why we we teach and learn the meditative process in which it becomes experiential. So now we have that which all is misery, no inner meaning. He says the soul becomes too cramped and she cannot remain within herself, nothing there to remain with. So third, she must desire nothing but God. We call it desire for deliverance. We want to get out. It's not satisfying. We want to get out of this. So he calls it desire nothing but God. And fourth one, none can comfort her but God. Four, with us, restless. There's such restlessness within that we can't find comfort with anything. So here, none can comfort her, the soul, but God. But the problem at that stage is she hasn't got God. She doesn't feel good. The soul doesn't feel good. She desires God, and she wants to be comforted by God, but it hasn't happened yet. So the fifth one is that she never returns to transient things. We call it abandoning fear and delight. The fear of that which we don't want and the delight in that which we want. Our human situation is such that we are constantly responding to that what we like with an attitude of wanting either, not only wanting to keep and wanting to have again. And that what we don't like, wanting to get rid of as quickly as possible. And since everything is transient and everything is movable and changeable, when that what we don't like disappears, that's very nice. But when that what we do like disappears, we don't like that at all. So we are constantly in a quandary. And not only are we in a quandary, we are also never totally satisfied. We can't be. And that's that inner feeling of there must be something else. Where is it? Why haven't I got it? I've got everything else. I've got the roof over my head. I've got all the things I need for my body. I've got the family. I've got everything. But where is that which will fully satisfy me within? And since we all know it's got to be somewhere within religion, how do we get at it? Here we have number five. She never returns to transient things. She's a soul, is no longer interested in that which brings fear and delight, which brings wanting and not wanting. And the sixth one, she has no inner peace till he, God, is restored to her. Now that sixth one, she still hasn't got it. She hasn't got any inner peace till he's restored to her. But in our language, it's called leaping to Nibbana. As the cessation of all formations. Now, these are, of course, all points of teaching, which are at the end of the line. So it's not easy to tell you about the teaching, which is the sort of the completeness of it when we're only just beginning to talk about Buddhism. But in any case, the soul has no inner peace till he, God, is restored to her. So what happens in the meditative process? At this point, the mind realizes that there is something to be found, which is all in the negative, just as we hear from Meister Eckhart, unconditioned, unborn, and therefore undying, and it totally still doesn't have any restlessness in it. So the mind looks for that. It's a cessation of all formations. It's that still point. It's a still point. The cessation of all formations is the traditional way of expressing it. But it is a still point in the mind, which the mind that is meditatively trained can find at a certain point, when it has gone through these other points of seeing nothing else will satisfy it. So these are steps of insight. The third one, which I picked out, are the steps on the jhanas, the meditative absorptions. Now, the meditative absorptions are the detailed explanation of the process which every single mind can go through in meditation and eventually will if they take meditation seriously. Now, if one does it once in a while, it will never happen. But if one takes it seriously and has determination, perseverance, and patience, and goes with it day after day, does sometime in the day, does this. And meditation in the Buddha's language is not that what that we take a topic, but it takes one pointed attention to the meditation subject, let's say the breath in this case. And as that happens and the mind becomes totally still, it goes into the different steps of the jhanas, the meditative absorptions. And there are eight. Now this one here is Sermon 84 by Meister Eckhart. And I have equated it to what is called the Samanapala Sutta. Samana is a recluse, an ascetic, a monk, a renunciate. And pala is the fruit. So it is the discourse on the fruit of the renunciate's life. And it is the one discourse that my teacher told me I must know from beginning to end out of 17,500 discourses that the Buddha gave. So this, in his opinion, was the most important discourse. And it tells all about of how we are now, what our hindrances are, and how we get on with it and go there. So here Meister Eckhart says, there are four reasons why the soul should arise and dwell above herself. Now, if the soul dwells above herself, what do we think about? Do we think that she's sitting here, now she's sitting there? Certainly not. It's not a space thing, is it, to be above oneself? It's an elevated consciousness. It's got to be. What else can it be? I mean, it can't be a sitting here, now here, no? It's not possible. So it's got to be an elevated consciousness. So she's got to sit above herself. The first reason is, for the manifold delights she finds in God, for God's perfection cannot contain itself. He must let creatures overflow from him, to whom he can impart himself, who can receive his likeness. The first jhana. In the Buddhist words, gladness springs up within him on his realizing that, and joy arises. Gladdened as he is, and so rejoicing, all his body becomes at ease, and being at ease, he's filled with a sense of peace, and in that peace his heart is stayed. And then, estranged from desires, aloof from evil dispositions, he enters into and remains in the first stage of meditation. Delights in God's perfection in the first jhana as peacefulness and rejoicing and gladdened. Then Meister Eckhart says, all that God can give the soul would be too little for her if God did not give himself in this gift. In our meditative language, this means that the personal I has to recede at that time. And this is the whole crux of the matter. That personal I has to go away eventually. And this is where we constantly misunderstand what we're being told. We would like to join with God, or we would like to enter into Nibbana, or we would like to have happiness. We would like to have spiritual peace. Not possible. Without the me, it's possible. And this is where the whole difficulty of understanding comes in. The practice only starts when we realize I've got to give up the one who wants. And only then is it possible to walk along that way. And that's why Eckhart is so difficult to understand, because he speaks from exactly that level, without the me. So here he has, God can give the soul, would be too little for her if God did not give himself in the gift. So the I has to go away, God is giving himself, so that there's also God. The second thing out of these four is that the soul should ascend for the purity that she finds in God, for in God all things are pure and noble. So the second jhana is, Suppressing all reasoning and investigation, one enters into and remains in the second stage of meditation, which is a state of joy and ease, born of the serenity of concentration, where no reasoning or investigation goes on, a state of elevation of mind. Now here we have the elevation of mind, which is the soul rising above itself. The jhanas, the meditative absorptions, are levels of consciousness which are differentiated from our ordinary level of consciousness by having unity in it and not duality. There's no duality in it. And they are available to anyone who wants to sit down and learn it and do it. And when it then happens, one knows, this is what I was looking for. And whether we call it the soul joining God or the soul being elevated or transcending the mind or whatever it is, it doesn't matter. They're just words. It's got to be the inner experience. And they're all talking about the same thing. And I haven't read all the mystics, but the ones I have read, they're all talking about the same things. There's Teresa de Avila, who I've really studied, Francisco de Osuna, who was her teacher. I've studied those well, and now Eckhart. They're all saying exactly the same thing. But because of the fact that we haven't done what they do, we don't know exactly what they're saying. And this is where we have the difficulty. The elevation of mind, a tranquilization of the heart. So here we have in the next sentence with Master Eckhart, in God there is light and being, in creatures there is darkness and nothingness, since what in God is light and being, in creatures is darkness and nothingness. So here it's called the tranquilization of the mind. Now comes the third thing the soul should do, which is the third jhana. The third thing is that the soul should ascend for the same she finds in God, for there's no different. Wisdom and goodness are one in God. What wisdom is, that very same is goodness, and what is mercy is the same as justice. If goodness in God were one thing and wisdom another, there would be no satisfaction for the soul in God. So here the third jhana is, holding aloof from joy, we become equable and mindful and self-possessed. We experience in the body that ease which the enlightened ones talk of when they say, the man serene and self-possessed is well at ease, and so he enters into and abides in the third stage of meditation. So there's total satisfaction at that time. One is totally at ease. The satisfaction is being at ease. Now comes an inside part. St. Augustine says, the souls in heaven are not completely blessed while they still have a leaning towards the body. And here we have, again with a fading as well of happiness as he bides in, mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body, he enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which the noble ones announce he has a pleasant abiding. The jhanas are only steps towards this, what we call Nibbana, which is what Master Eckhart says is the Godhead. And he says that, he quotes St. Augustine, says that souls in heaven are not completely blessed while they still have a leaning towards the body. So here we also still have a leaning, we have still pleasure with the body, so we're only on our third step. There's one thing in here which I might just mention very briefly. Meister Eckhart talks about higher powers. The Buddha does too, but I don't think that it's very interesting, because Meister Eckhart says, for however much the soul might achieve with that power whereby she grasps created things, and if God had made 1,000 heavens and 1,000 earths, she could well grasp them by that power. Now, that's called higher powers in Buddhism, and there are many ways of explaining that. It's sort of supernatural powers. We call them supernatural powers, I think, in our daily language. But here's another part which is very interesting. Meister Eckhart says, if all the pains of hell were poured onto a soul, she still would not wish not to be. That shows how much a creature loves its own being, which it has received directly from God. The Buddha says, sensual desires here and now, sensual desires in lives to come, are all Mara's realm. Mara is the devil in Buddhist terminology, but not a person with a clump foot or something like that, but the tempter in one's own heart. Are all Mara's realm, Mara's domain, Mara's bait, Mara's hunting ground. Evil, unprofitable notions of covetousness and ill will and ambition lead on to rebirth here in the sensual desire sphere. So it's the same thing. The pains of hell are the soul would still want to be. So we have the sensual desires which put us into the tempter's realm. The soul must dwell above herself if she's to lay hold of God. And Buddha says, by transcending the world and resolving firmly with the mind, there would be no more evil and unprofitable notions. And with the abandoning of them, the mind would be limited no longer. It would become measureless. So if the mind is measureless, that is laying hold of that which is all-pervading. In other words, what is called God by Meister Eckhart. Now here's a passage from Meister Eckhart which I puzzled over quite a long while, and I think it's very puzzling, but I have come to a conclusion on it. The infinite God who is in the soul, he grasps the God who is infinite. Then God grasps God, and God makes God in the soul and shapes her after himself. It's quite a passage, isn't it? Well, what I understand it to be is what is the Nibbanic element. The Nibbanic element is the ground of being, the matrix of existence, the pervading all, that from which all emanates, which has no distinction, no individuality, in which there is nothing that can be said to be such or such. It just is. And this is what I understand this passage to mean, because that is within the soul. If God is all pervading, can grasp God, who is infinite, and then when God does that, so one in the soul grasps the one who is infinite, and then it becomes that which is shaped exactly as the all-pervading matrix of existence, or whichever way we want to call it. Meister Eckhart calls it the Godhead. And the Godhead, in German, Godheit, is not distinctive enough for most people to see that this is a totally different thing from God. He makes it very clear in another passage. I think I have it here somewhere. I'll find it in a minute. Now then, the fourth thing is that the soul should arise for the limitlessness she finds in God, for all things are in God new and timeless. The thing about new and timeless in our language is called born into the dispensation of the noble ones. When we are newly born into the dispensation of the noble ones, it means we have seen Nibbana for one moment ourselves. And here we have the fourth thing, that the soul should arise for the limitlessness she finds in God, that which is all. And therefore in God everything is new and timeless. So we are newly born at that time. All things are new in the Son, for he is being born today of the Father, which is the same thing that we say that is a new, completely new rebirth at that time, because that which is personal has been eliminated. Now, I'd like to make one point very, very importantly clear. I think I heard it earlier in one of the talks. There is no negation of self. This is very important. Neither Eckhart nor the Buddha negate me, body, or self. What is being done by one who gains entry into the all-pervading matrix of existence is to see the illusion of self. That's all. There's a great difference in that. Self, me, separation, individuality, separateness is an illusion. That is being seen. There's no negation of self. Something which doesn't exist cannot be negated. The only thing that's happening is that the illusion is seen for what it is. And one has, so to say, clear vision to see that this is only mind made, the mind that thinks and not the one that experiences. So here we have with Meister Eckhart, thus the soul dies to herself before she steps into God. I think it's exactly what I just said, isn't it? This is the most important aspect of the whole teaching of the Buddha, and in Buddhism it's called anatta or sunyata. Anatta, atta means me, an means non-me, and sunyata means emptiness. Both are of the same, are the same, same essence, because the non-me means also the corelessness. So the soul has to die to herself before she steps into God. There can not be any individuality. And this is why it's so extremely difficult, as I've already said before. We would like it very much if we could get it. But we can't get it. We've got to let go of it. And as we let go and become one with that, which really is, there's nobody here. The Buddha expresses this like this. He says, there is suffering, but no sufferer. There's a deed, but no doer. There's a path, but no one to enter. And there's nibbana, but no one to attain it. The soul dies to herself before she steps into God. Now, we have... I never get finished in an hour, you know. I just finish when the hour is up. The soul takes four steps into God. The first is that there's fear, hope, and desire grow in her. Now we have in this sutta, in this discourse, exactly four steps, just like he has. And the first one is fear. Because as I mentioned already before, we see that everything is dissolving. He doesn't explain the fear. The Buddha explains. He says, we see that everything that we thought was solid, and that is an illusion, isn't it? We all know we're going to die. It isn't solid, is it? And we can also see that the solidity that we're banking on is really an illusion, because we can't keep our thoughts, our feelings. We can keep none of it. So there's fear. And then there's desire. And the desire is for deliverance, as I mentioned before. And then fear, hope, and desire are quite cut off. And that's called disenchantment in Buddhist language. It's called nibbida in Pali. The disenchantment with the world. That doesn't mean we cannot continue to live in it. We've got to. We've got a body. So we've got to live in the world. We've got to do all the things that are necessary to keep going. But what we lose at that point, that may be important, is our expectation that the world is going to bring us satisfaction, that there's something out there somewhere, if we only did it the right way, that would bring total happiness, total peacefulness, total satisfaction and fulfillment. That expectation is finished at that moment. There is no name or fame that can do it. There's no gain, nothing that will do it. There's no person that will do it. It just doesn't exist. And if we examine everything that there is in the world, then we'll know that. We'll know it from our own experience. So our fear and hope and desire are cut off. We're disenchanted. We're no longer enchanted with it all. That doesn't mean we're disgusted. It just means we're not enchanted. And the third step then, at the third stage, she comes to a forgetfulness of all temporal things. That's called dispassion in Buddhist language, viraga. The forgetfulness of temporal things means that we do not search for them. Doesn't mean exactly that we forget everything that's happening in the world, although the disinterest in it makes it much easier to keep the mind still and calm. Because we don't feel so concerned with what's in the world. We know that it's all temporary and transient, that it's all man-made and doesn't have that underlying importance that we have given it until then. And then number four, at the fourth stage, she enters into God, where she will eternally dwell, reigning with God in eternity, reigning with God in eternity. So that's being God. I am that. And then she will never again think of temporal things or of herself, being fused with God and God with her. And what she then does, she does in God. And then he says, may God help us to take these steps here and die, that we may rejoice in him in eternity. So at the fourth stage, she enters into God, where she will eternally dwell. In our language, it's called Nibbana, and it's called the unconditioned. It doesn't have any condition to exist. Now, this body has a condition. It has to be fed. It has to be has to drink. It has to sleep. It has to be born. That all sorts of conditions. The heart has to beat. The breath has to come. Everything that we see around us is all conditioned. The meditative steps that I was trying to explain are all conditioned. They have the condition of concentration. But then the matrix of existence is unconditioned. It's unborn and therefore undying. So that is the fourth step, that she enters into God, and as she enters into God, there she will eternally dwell, reigning with God. The eternally dwell, if it's taken personally, I can assure you it won't happen. The eternally dwell is that which is overall no individuality. I have one more sermon here, which is quite lengthy. I think it's from the sermons I've read, and I have to admit I haven't read them all. I haven't had time to read them all. But I have read those that I thought, well, you know, they might be useful. This one here I found the most wonderful one. It's the one which says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I think it's a fantastically well-explained exposition of the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha. But it takes a while. So I'll take this one here, which doesn't take very long. We have in the Buddhist explanation four stages of enlightenment, which are four separate moments of recognizing Nibbana. It means each time that the feeling and the idea, both, are of self, of me, are completely given up. And one enters into that which has the timeless element, that which has no individuality, which is universal. It's a deliberate step which can be taken in or out of meditation, but is always a result of the meditative process in which the mind has become purified, because meditation purifies automatically. 1 second of concentration is 1 second of purification. We can't think negatively when we're concentrated. We can't do two things at a time, luckily. So this has four stages. And these four stages have four names, and they are explained, interestingly enough, in the discourse by Meister Eckhart called The Noble Man. The first stage of the inner man and the new man, St. Augustine says, is that a man lives by the example of good and saintly people, though he still holds on to chairs and supports himself by walls and subsists on milk. It's very interesting because the Buddha often talks about the importance of good, noble friends. In fact, his cousin, Ananda, who was for 25 years looking after him, and was his most devoted disciple, said to him once, sir, a good friend is half of the holy life. And the Buddha said, do not say so, Ananda. A good friend is the whole of the holy life. So here it is said by St. Augustine, which Meister Eckhart quotes, that a man lives by the example of good and saintly people. We need noble friends and noble conversations, the Buddha said. So he still acts like an ordinary person. He still holds onto chairs and supports himself by walls and subsists on milk. Well, I take this, which is the first stage of the inner man and the new man, to be the stream enterer. A stream enterer has perfect morality, but he still has the hate and greed of an ordinary person. We all have hate and greed due to the fact that we think of ourselves as individuals, which is called delusion in the Buddhist language. The second stage is when he not merely regards the outward examples and good people, but runs and hastens to the teaching and counsel of God and divine wisdom, and turns his back on mankind and his face towards God, crawling forth from his mother's lap to smile up at his heavenly Father. So here we have, and it goes on a little further, we have the second stage, which we call the once returner, which are technical terms. I don't think I want to go into them, the technical terminology. But we do not know, not only do we regard the outward example and good people, but we actually come to the point where divine wisdom, in Master Eckhart's words, in the Buddha's words, the shedding of the fetters helps us to have less greed and hate. It doesn't eliminate greed and hate, but in second step, sheds it to the point where it is much less. The third stage is when a man withdraws more and more from his mother and, being further and further from her lap, escapes from care and casts off fear, so that even if he might with impunity do evil and injustice to all, he would have no wish to do so, for he is so bound to God with love and eagerness until God establishes and leads him in joy, sweetness and bliss, wherein he cares nothing for whatever is repugnant and alien to God. It is said of the stream enterer, the first one, and the once returner, that they cannot possibly break any of the precepts, which are the moral rules. They can't do it. Even if they wished to, like Master Eckhart said, they couldn't do it. It's impossible. Then comes the next step. It's when he grows more and more and becomes rooted in love and in God, so that he is ready to welcome any trial, temptation, adversity, and suffering willingly, gladly, eagerly, and joyfully. When he lives altogether at peace with himself, resting calmly in the richness and abundance of the supreme ineffable wisdom. We'd call that the non-returner, which is the next step, the fourth step. This is four and five taken together from Eckhart. The non-returner has shed the fetter of hate and greed. He still has five other fetters because he still has the feeling of self so finely imbued in him that it is as if it was the aroma of a flower, which is still attached to the flower. So it's very finely still imbued in that person, the non-returner, but he has gotten rid of hate and greed. So here he's completely at peace with himself, resting calmly in the richness and abundance of the supreme ineffable wisdom. And the sixth stage in Meister Eckhart, which is the fourth one in the Buddhas, is when a man is deformed, D with a hyphen to formed, it's completely newly formed, it's a totally different person, and transformed by God's eternity, and has attained total forgetfulness of transitory temporal life, and is drawn and translated into a divine image, having become the child of God. Beyond this, there's no higher stage, and there is eternal rest and bliss, for the final end of the inner man and the new man is eternal life. Now, that eternal life must not be understood to be the life of that person, because the person has been deformed and transformed by God's eternity and has forgotten all transitory temporal life. And therefore, that would be equivalent to the Nibbanic element, the holy person, which comes to the final and total realization of that which is that from which all emanates, but which is unborn, undying, and which makes that person a holy one, an arahant. Arahant in the Buddha's language is a holy one. And a holy one, we can say here, it's drawn and translated into a divine image. And not only, well, he says it's a child of God, but there's no higher stage. And if there's no higher stage and eternal rest and bliss, that would translate into Nibbana, which is the goal of the Buddha's teaching. I have used up my allotted time, so I shall leave Sermon 87, The Blessed Are the Poor in Spirit, maybe for next year. Thank you very much.
Thank you.